can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious!
Well now, boys and girls, Sue Stanley's here, Don Scott is here, Ivan is here from, just Ivan, his name's actually Paul, but now we call him Ivan, and we've got our first guest in for the year, Don, which wouldn't be hard seeing as we're only 4 days into the year, or is it three? I'm going to read out who our guest is, Don. And I think it's appropriate that we have a person of this standing and this ilk coming in today because things are getting fractious out there in the community for a whole lot of different reasons, and this person oversees a lot of the things that go on and makes decisions. I think I've got that right, but she'll correct me if it's a woman. She's a woman. This is who, I'm reading this off the machine. A former journalist, and she'll tell me if any of this is not relevant, a former journalist and published writer who has spent 28 years in policing, I said policing earlier, creating innovative solutions to forensic intelligence, post-sentence management, women's barriers to success, and strategic planning in education. She's currently leading family violence, sexual assault and child abuse responses for the Victoria Police and Family Violence Command. That is who we're about to speak to. Her name is Lauren Calloway, and she's, I think at this stage, the Assistant Commissioner for Family Violence Command. Is any of that correct, Lauren, and welcome?
All of it's correct, so thank you.
Well, heavens above. First of all, her name is Lawrence Calloway. Lauren Calloway. I want to ask how her golf clubs are going. how many sets of golf clubs have you sold around the world, the Calloway brand?
It is spelt the same way, so I always do say that. And sometimes people look at me and go, what are you talking about?
And that's a very interesting thing you say, Lauren, because I looked up just to get this information, because I've never met you before, and I looked up Lauren Calloway, and I spelled it with a K. There were 40,000 people called Lauren Calloway, and I thought, shit, how will I... how will I find out? And then I checked my notes again, and it's spelled with a C. So as soon as I put Lauren Calloway in with a C, Don, up she came, and here she is. So... you've heard who she is. My first question is, you'll probably be across this. You remember a man called Sean Connery who was ex-James Bond.
Yes.
He doubled down recently on, well, not recently because he's dead now, but he doubled down. He made this original statement and then someone said, do you regret ever saying this? And he said, no, I do. He said, it's quite all right to slap a woman. Just if she gets out of control and there's no other alternative. What would you say to the late James Bond and Sean Connery who said that?
Well, if he said it in front of me, I'd say, are you serious?
You cannot be serious, which is exactly the name of our podcast. Well, anyhow, he had quite a measured response to it. He said, no, sometimes people become hysterical and just to get them in line, just to get their attention. I'll just mention that. I'm sure I knew you'd have that response. So Lauren, just my first question is, it says here there's approximately, I think I read this here somewhere, 2 million instances of family violence a year. Is that right or did I read that incorrectly?
That would probably be across Australia. In Victoria, we have around 92,000.
It's approximately 2 million Australian examples of sexual assault in Australia a year. Would that be right?
I think that would be close to being right.
It all depends what you mean by it, don't you?
Family violence is... obviously more reported now than it's ever been, but sexual assault still remains to be a very underreported crime. So what they normally do is we anticipate that 1 in 10 incidents of sexual assault get reported. So whatever the whole bucket of police numbers added up across Australia, you could times it by 10 to say, well, that's the actual rate that sexual assault is happening.
So you have identified, so family violence is not just necessarily to do with sexual violence. It can be, and I'm reading this off some of your notes.
Yes.
That it can be, it's of course physical threats, mm-hmm. sexual violence, emotional violence, economic violence, economic strategies, bullying, and social isolation. So there's a whole lot of ways that people can be intimidated by their respective partners or people who transgress, and it's not necessarily to do with sex, but the majority of it probably is it?
It's not the majority. I mean, we can only go on what victim survivors tell us, but it's just under 40% of sexual violence occurs within a family relationship context. So, you know, often people talk about the stranger, you know, I think for women, public safety, being worried that someone's going to attack them. It's more than likely if someone is to be sexually assaulted, it'll be by someone they know, whether that's in a family context or a social setting. It's less likely to be someone randomly walking down the street.
Lauren, why would the police department set up the police force set up a department expressly to look after this? Isn't it a matter of law that, it, you know, they make that judgment? You either have transgressed or you haven't.
Mm-hmm.
Why set up a department to do this?
Well, I think because we're ahead of everywhere else in Australia. We were the first, and up until recently Queensland have joined us, but we were the first policing jurisdiction to set up a dedicated family violence command. And when we say family violence command, we are including sexual assault and child abuse. The reason that we were set up around probably about 7 years ago had to do with the state government setting up a Royal Commission into family violence. And Victoria Police got 22 recommendations out of that Royal Commission to basically reform the whole process to responding to this crime. You are right, it is breaking the law. It is 40% of a general duties police officer's job, but we set this command up to bring specialisation and expertise to the crime theme. So if you go back 10 years ago, even longer, if you wanted to report family violence, generally the complaint was that police didn't do much about that. It was a private matter. You know, you don't call the police. We called them unhappy marriages in the 70s, 80s and 90s. But now we acknowledge it's a crime. We have a pro-arrest, pro-action policy, and my command drives the standards of that across the state.
But aren't you going into it a little bit too deep? You either transgress or you don't transgress, and you just go in and make a decision. If there's violence, you apprehend and you charge.
No.
Well, I think what you're sort of angling towards is what we would call the traditional notion of family
black and
violence.
White. It's not black and white,
and
all of it,
it's not black
it?
And white anymore.
Well, I understand it's not black and white. No, there's two parties to every situation. But, you know, are you a result of today's society where we try to overanalyze a situation and we seem to lose track of where we're going?
Oh, look, I don't think we're losing track. We've got the broadest definition of family violence in the country, and I think that's for a very good reason. I know of many victim survivors who weren't ever actually hit, but they weren't allowed to access credit cards.
Yeah,
they
so
were
all
told
those
what
things
to wear.
I mentioned
exactly.
There, those things.
They weren't allowed to see their family and friends.
Emotional, economic, bullying, social isolation. Yeah. So, Lauren Kellaway, it says we tend to think that it's mainly, well, it is mainly because it says the statistics here, 75% of it is males doing it against females, but there is a 25% instance where females sexually, physically harass males.
That is true. Whenever I talk about it, it is a gendered
harm crime.
But we always
hone in on the men doing it.
Well,
which is probably right
because
it's
the
majority.
Yeah, if we're going to design a response model, we tend to look at, well, where's the biggest, you know, part of this happening? And so, roughly, it is intimate partner violence between men and women, men as the perpetrator and women as the affected family member. But I agree with you, there is a huge chunk of people, and if you're talking about 92,000 incidents, they're not small numbers, where women may be the perpetrator. It might be a same-sex relationship. It might. We know that boys can be perpetrators against their parents, so adolescent family violence and elder abuse. Now, elder abuse can occur by both men and women against their parents. So there is a third, I suppose, of all incidents that don't fit the gender formula, and we acknowledge that.
So please don't think I'm being flippant, but if women can be the main perpetrator, maybe Sean Connery might have been right that he might slap a woman back if she attacks him.
No, he's not right. The reason why, if you think about it, right, I don't know how many kilos Sean Connery weighed, but I'm pretty sure it would be twice as much as his partner. When we come to an incident, we have to make a judgment call on who is most in need of safety and who is most in fear.
So if you had a big woman attack a smaller husband or smaller man, that plays into the calculations?
We'd have to take in the history of family violence between the parties, the dynamics of the relationship, who has the most control, lots of things. It's not just a single incident assessment.
So when are you called in? When are you actually called into the incident?
Typically, most calls come in through 000 at the crisis end.
No, but what I'm saying, do the ordinary police on the beat go and investigate a domestic violence, or do they ring you straight away and you're on the scene in 5 minutes?
I understand. No, the van. The van is the frontline first responder to all family violence incidents. Once the police get there, we make an assessment around how serious it is.
They make an assessment?
They make an assessment, yes. We being the role, we of Victoria Police. My command owns the standards, the practices, the policy, the engagement with the government. The work is owned by regional operations who send police out. And then a portion of those jobs that the van goes to become a job that the specialist unit, the family violence
unit, which you're in charge of.
Well, they're also in the regions. We are, as I said, our command is a what I would call a strategy, policy and standards type command.
Hang on. Do you set the policy then? So the officers in the van apply your philosophy to the situation.
Yes, that's right. And if there's things that need to change, if we see things happening out in the front line that we think it's not quite aligned to where we want to go with where the government's heading.
So you write the brief and they act on it, more or less?
Yeah.
You write the parameters?
Yes, that's right. Yep.
So I don't know how long this movement has officially been in inverted commas going, but the Me Too movement, have you noticed more traffic or more involvement in this situation since the Me Too movement, and women have become more prevalent at going and reporting it, whereas they tried to deal with it? I don't even know what I'm asking you, but has the Me Too movement increased your workload?
Yes, it has. I would add to that the Grace Tame story and the Brittany Higgins story. So historical reporting of sex offending is on the rise. More women are now coming forward. We've also noticed quite a difference since COVID lockdown. And I do wonder whether or not, you know, when people sat with their own thoughts and their own experiences over 2 years being at home and having everything else sort of taken away from them, whether or not they felt that it was time that they would report the incident to police.
So do you have an opinion on the Brittany Higgins situation? I have an opinion on it. You probably wouldn't want to hear it, and it has nothing to do with bias or me being a man or her being a woman. Seriously, how would you adjudicate what went on there?
Oh, gosh, I don't think...
Well, that's right, exactly.
Yeah. It's difficult, but I'll say this. Whilst the trial was going on, I often go to, say, dinner parties or with people, and her case would come up. Even the mere fact they call it the Brittany Higgins case,
yep.
And they don't refer to the perpetrator. She's actually not on trial. And people would start to say little things like, oh, well, you know, she had that much to drink and who does this and who... And I was like, whoa, it's just... Are you trying to tell me that a woman is responsible for what happens to her because she's drunk too much?
Lauren, I'm not getting into it. Because I don't want you to sit in and think, oh, yes, I would say that. I'm not saying that at all, but that's all from her side of it. What about if the man was in a similar condition and was being just as careless or frivolous and... Why do people immediately take the side of her condition and not maybe the other person's condition?
Well, it's funny that you say that because good. I think people have taken both sides in this case. It's been quite polarising. As to, you know, one of the things that often comes out is that women find themselves a victim of sexual assault when they've agreed to do things and then they've got regret. I mean, we hear lots of comments that come out of cases and that just don't ring true as to why a woman would report a sexual assault in the first place. So there's a lot of misconceptions, I think, yep. around how many women who decide to say they're going to be sexually assaulted and potentially they weren't.
So going on from there, the yes. logical extension of that is celebrities and sports men, not mm-hmm. sports women, who get into trouble at venues and have a certain number of women who like to be attracted by those celebrities and play up to them and all that, and between one thing and another it leads to a disaster, and then the woman regrets this and then all hell breaks loose. This must be really hard for people like you to judge just on what basis all this happened or happens.
Yeah, and look, luckily I suppose in my role, I have sympathy for the attending police officer who has to work through all the information in front of them. But from my perspective, we get to look at this as a whole crime theme. And I feel very comfortable with the idea that women and children are mostly affected by sexual assault and sexual harm. And that the power dynamics of how men treat women with respect or lack thereof play into these kinds of crimes.
Where do you get your information from to come to a policy?
Well, a couple of ways. Crime statistics is one way we look at it. But we also talk to victim survivors and we also engage. We're part of a whole of government, both in sexual assault and family violence, a whole of government response. And we get a lot of information from our other partners. So, for example...
Who would be your other partners?
Family violence, social workers, government and non-government agencies, crisis accommodation, justice department, a whole range of people are actually working across the system to collectively provide a response to victims.
So a friend of ours and a friend of mine, a bloke called, you would know him well, Phil Cleary.
Yes.
He's
an advocate,
who's,
yep.
sister was murdered.
Yep.
Whenever I talk about these things, about probably the things we've spoken, he will ring me up and say, now, mate, and I say, I'm only just being the devil's advocate about all this, Phil. I have the same philosophy as you, but, you know, it's no good preaching to the converted. We may as well get both sides of the story. He would be a very strong advocate of yours, of course, as we all are. Mm-hmm. We all are, Lauren. Do you ever speak to him or does he ever get in contact with you? Or?
Well, funnily enough, I think I saw him at a Frankston Football Club event a couple of years ago and we yep. had a bit of a chat.
Yep.
I would say we move in the same circles yep. of people who are interested in, you know, addressing men's violence against women. He's definitely in that circle. But that's why I'm so happy to be invited here today, because I think most of the time we are preaching to the converted
yep.
and we want to get the message out to everybody yes. else who wouldn't normally, they're not going to turn up in the city and walk, you know, on a march in orange against violence. So that's kind of where we want to get to.
Policing has changed over years. I wonder whether it was as prevalent what you're addressing now in years gone by. I will go back 40 or 50 years.
Yeah, look, I don't have 40 years of data, but I got 20 years, and you know.
But policing was different. In other words, you know, a police officer would go around, mm-hmm. and if he believed there was, it'd be straightened out.
Take the big waddy out.
In a physical manner, or a threat would be made. And so policing was completely different.
Mm, absolutely.
Now society has changed, so society has really created what you're addressing.
Yeah, and I think those shifting attitudes are the right. They're shifting in the right direction.
And I suppose that was the physical side of things, wasn't it? When back in the day, the police used to do that. Now we're in that grey area where mental health comes into it. And you mentioned about the training aspects and you making the policies. How do you implement that? And is there enough training going into our frontliners?
Yeah, there is. We were lucky that the state government invested in Victoria Police, and we have a Centre for Family Violence out at the Academy. It's a $10 million centre. We provide training now from everyone from a recruit all the way up to a superintendent. And it's training, it's continual, like I suppose, career life training. And it's also, we've got training out in the field. We put about 30 senior sergeants out with the front line, and their job is to watch how the jobs are being managed, and they call it nudge training, and bring police officers in to say, well, hang on, you could do this in a better way. We've observed you're not doing the risk assessment in the right way. You need to do this. So we've accepted it's not a sheep dip version, you know, where you have it once and then you're set for life. No.
And it's going to take a little bit of time to actually implement that and training over the years to come because it's just so relatively new.
But I know, I look at the stats, over 100,000 intervention orders are applied for, over 92,000 reports of family violence being taken. So I have great faith in the fact that if you call us, we do something about it.
Do you find a certain percentage of those intervention orders are just a revenge or just people trying to get back at their partner for officially having someone come around and tell them not to...
Yeah, look, that...
To embarrass them.
Yeah. Look, there's no doubt amongst those 100,000, there are people who...
Use the system.
Yeah, who decide, well, if she's getting an intervention order against me, I'll get one against her. But I do think it does provide some level of safety. I think you know yourself. When you have a breakup, most people leave with dignity. You go that way. That person goes that way.
Yeah.
When that doesn't work...
No,
now,
fair enough.
I'm saying most, but when that doesn't work, there's a certain percentage of people who go to a lawyer and then, you know, letters start flying past, and then there's a certain percentage of people who just won't simply accept that the relationship is over.
No.
And you need to get an intervention order to stop the behaviour.
I tell you what, Lauren, I don't think I could disagree with you anymore.
No,
you would know, that would be my naivety. Now, Lauren Calloway, do you have any race-based data that tells you, and you probably know where I'm coming from here, but I'm not being specific, is the more sections of the community become more involved in this, and some of the sections of the community have their own form of dealing with punishment and probably not as the law would require. Do you find that a nightmare?
It is a difficult one to get through. I think the messaging and what I see in certain communities, there is a reluctance to engage with the police. We don't collect data based on race, but what I do know is that there are vulnerable communities, and they are cold communities. They are people with a disability. Their carer might be the abuser. And, you know, we talk about not hitting, controlling medication and controlling someone's ability to be out in society is another form of abuse. So, yeah, there's definitely particular vulnerabilities that apply to people who aren't just naturally going about their daily life in Australia and feeling confident to go and report to the police.
But also, this is also an inherent problem too, isn't it, in communities? It gets the same practices are repeated through the generations.
Yes.
Is that a fair comment too?
That is a fair comment.
So how do you address that if it's, I don't think it's systemic, but it's inherent. How do you address that with regard?
Yeah, and look, we call that intergenerational violence, and I see it a lot when I talk to victim survivors, and this is where I think the police can't solve all problems. No. We work with, you know, you've got to have other people coming to the party to deal with intergenerational violence. So you want substance abuse, mental health workers, housing. Lack of housing is one of the biggest areas where family violence is contributing to people ending up on the streets.
So when people come to this country with different standards and cultures and different ways of dealing with what role women play in their society, and they come here to a fairly egalitarian place that we live in, and even the Indigenous people that live here, it must be a minefield to try and get a paradigm of punishment, a standard of punishment that fits and is accepted by all those different groups in the melting pot of their cultures.
Yeah, and look, Lauren. we don't hand out the punishment. That's done by the courts. But what I will say, the message that has come out loud and clear, and I meet with a lot of multicultural groups and I have a lot to do with the Aboriginal community, is the community leaders in those groups say really strongly, family violence is not part of our culture. That is not part of it. So they are clear that it's still criminal offending.
Yeah, but so if they've been used to that in their countries of origin, and they come here, and it's pretty hard to teach an old dog new tricks, which for a very bad analogy, but you know what I mean.
I know what you mean.
It's a very bad analogy. I'm sorry about that. But just to change the habit of a culture just because they come to another country and they say, no, this is how we live and we're going to live our life out here, but we'll obey most of the rules. We won't speed and we won't do all that, but we'll. That's how we control our family's situation.
Yeah.
But there's
a lot of Australian men who have got some pretty poor attitudes to women as well. Yeah.
So do you advise people who are under threat, do you provide safe houses and safe communities or safe living spaces, or do you advocate that, or is that left to the law?
No, when we turn up, we do what we call is a family violence report, and it's sort of got three purposes. It's a crime report of what has happened. It is a risk assessment. We ask 39 questions to figure out whether this is a low, medium or high risk situation. And the third bit it does is it's a referral process. So one of the most important jobs for the police officer to do at the time is to decide whether or not the perpetrator has to be excluded from the home, or whether or not women and children will be going into refuge. So we will make those decisions at the time. But having said that, there's actually a whole group of people who don't ring the police, and they will ring Safe Steps is the primary crisis accommodation point in Victoria. They'll make their own way to safety. The model is many pathways into safety. So yes, some will come through police, and we'll do the referrals and everything that is associated with making sure everyone's safe, dealing with any injuries, crimes committed. But not all of the business comes in that direction.
Are those refuges and safe houses, they're anonymous?
No one
knows where they are.
No one knows where they are.
So that's obviously the point of it, isn't it? So that the people who feel aggrieved can't come around and still do harassment from known addresses. Yeah.
Well,
and they're dotted around the community, are they, the safe houses?
You make a good point in that when someone decides to leave, and we know it takes up to maybe 7 or 8 interventions before they actually leave someone, that is a really risky time. That, court dates, child access conversations, you know, that actually raises the stakes for the victim survivors who are leaving. So we've got to be really careful. I know there's always a thought, why doesn't she just leave? Or once you've reported to police, is that done and dusted? She goes his way. Her way, he goes his way.
Because the intimidation under threat of maybe just murder, like just murder.
Yeah.
Being threatened with murder if they leave, or
yeah, that's what's the threats of harm. Sometimes it's just the threatening that actually keeps someone under control. But I have noticed a real shift in the numbers lately around ex-partners. So, you would think, all right, you're in a toxic relationship, a violent relationship, you break up, that's the end of the matter. For some people, it can be the start of a campaign of harassment.
How long does it take? You just started to touch on 7 or 8 weeks. How long does it take you to actually get involved? Can you do that in a day? You go to, or the police go to a situation one day and the next day, or it's addressed right there and then. Who makes that decision?
Yeah, it's a good question, because police have certain responsibilities to make people safe. And so we may, even if the victim, survivor, is saying, well, I don't want him arrested, we will override that decision and make the necessary decisions we've got to make to make that environment safe. Now, what happens after that is another thing. So we sometimes go against what I would call victim agency. And we appreciate that victims are worried and they're doing their own risk assessment in their head. I'm sure every morning, every day, they are figuring out, do I do something, do I not do something? And of course, if the neighbours call us and we get there, some things will be taken out of their hands.
One thing that's fascinated me over the years, why do females remain in an abusive relationship? And I'm talking about a physical relationship. Well, physically. Why do they stay there?
Well, there's lots of reasons, but the ones that probably come to mind first is they have nowhere else to go. So they may not have, we assume women today have all got access to money and freedom and independence, but it's not the case. If they've got children, they don't want to remove their children from the school. If they're in a close-knit community, they don't want to be embarrassed by potentially leaving that community. I think what it comes down to is, as I say, they're doing their own risk assessment every day and judging, maybe I can last a little longer till the kids get to high school, or maybe I can manage this in a different way. And of course,
others have come to me. I've spoken to women about it, and they've said, "Oh well, he apologised. He broke down. He cried. He did this. He was remorseful, and whatever else." And I thought, "Shit, how many times have you got to do this? And how many times has this got to keep going on before you make a decision?"
And I think there's an assumption too that someone who's violent is violent all the time. Well, no, they're not. People get together in the most happy, loving circumstances. And then sometimes it's just the thin end of the wedge, and it takes a long time for
drug,
a person
drinking
to become
or drugs or whatever.
Of those things can exacerbate it too. But I always say, well, drinking alcohol isn't the reason you're violent. You've made a choice. I feel at times there can be a lot of excuses applied to the behaviour of people who are violent when they actually just made a decision to do it. Because if they're at work and they don't like what someone said, or they lose a bit of control, you don't go and abuse your boss, So it's a choice thing. But
it's a catch-22, Lauren, isn't it? Surely if you're not violent most of the time and you have a few drinks, and drinking doesn't make you jovial and laconic, it makes you aggressive and violent, then that is the panacea, isn't it? You come home and your partner might say something, just a very normal thing that irritates you, and bang, that's the trigger, isn't it? Isn't it? I know it's no excuse, but of course it's no excuse. But
I think if you woke up the next day and there's a hole in your wall, or your partner is sleeping in a spare room, or you have in any way physically threatened her or assaulted her, well, I think the next decision is you don't drink again.
Or seek help, because they're not going to stop drinking, are they?
Yeah.
Well, they've got help.
The thing is, it's a very Australian thing to do in Australia, to have a drink and socialise. I think the men's behaviour change piece of this conversation is very interesting.
Sorry, what did you say? I didn't get that. What did you say?
The men's behaviour change. Because, that's what happens out of a court case at some point. Most women want the violence to stop, but not necessarily the relationship. They don't want that part of the relationship. So there is a role for men's behaviour change, for men to say, I've got a problem, I need to stop this, and go into some form of therapeutic treatment.
Or I'll go into jail if I don't. That might be a great deterrent.
That can work sometimes.
Or getting a touch-up on the way through. What about women? What about women? They're very good psychologically in hooking. I call it hooking.
Oh, yeah. And can you explain hooking?
Yes, hooking, snaring someone.
You know, you're fishing and you're...
Not out being a hooker, Don.
Very good at it. You know, men and women separated, in my view, back in the Middle Ages, when men went one way, women went the other way. Now, men react differently in a physical manner. How much can the woman play in the blame of hooking? And then there's a retaliatory action. A man is very, very frustrated.
Yeah. Look, I mean, what you're describing to me is kind of the human nature, isn't it, around people.
Relationships.
Around relationships. And my respect goes out to the frontline police officer. Some of them will be in their 20s. We can train. We can do everything to give them the tools to try and work it out as to who's done what, but there are simply some cases where I couldn't make the call, you know. And not just police, it's also magistrates.
So in that situation, a woman, we don't know what's gone on to instigate or...
But it's our job to find out, and it's our job to present as much information as possible to the court so they can make a decision that's based on making sure everybody remains safe and children aren't harmed going forward.
So trying to cover all bases, Lauren.
It's not an easy job.
My dear, I think we should go back to the old policing ways, I think.
Oh, okay.
Try and cover this question.
Oh. Throw it at me.
No, I think this is probably a minefield now. With the LGBTQ+ and the transgender relationships, how do you work out if the same-sex partners or someone is transgendered? How do you work out? Because it's not just a man and a woman. It's now people, women and women, and men, and men are saying they're women, and vice versa. Has that added a whole different category of trying to resolve family crisis situations or violence?
Yes, I think it has. I think the positive aspect is that more people from the LGBTIQ+A, whichever way you want to go with it, will report to police these days, which I'm very happy about, because I think in the past they didn't feel confident to come forward and report to police. Our job is to train to those nuances, to explain better the power dynamics in those types of relationships. And the main thing I ask police to do is don't just look at the single incident in front of you. Yes, you do that for all other crimes, but not for these types of crimes. You need to spend time with both parties, ask the questions to find out who is in most need of safety, who is in most fearful in this situation. And that's why we are engaging with the sector, the LGBTIQA+ sector, to understand what are the things we can do as police that make us better to responding to the crimes that they are involved in.
And because they've only got a really nanosecond to make that decision. And I was in... I've got two friends, and they're two males in a strong relationship. But one is a big guy, and one guy is a little guy. But the little guy was the angry ant, and the big guy wasn't. But when the police actually went there, they actually took the side of the little angry ant, because he could have been... They thought maybe the bigger one was a bit more threatening. But they've only got that really nanosecond to make a decision, haven't they? I mean, that's a tough call.
Yeah, and what I say is don't make that decision quickly. Spend the time to actually have conversations with both parties. Separate them, because that's the other thing we see, is if you talk to people together, some people won't say anything while the police are there. They're too terrified to. So we've got to separate the parties, spend the time talking about it. But you make a good point around judgment. You can't just assume that person's the perpetrator and that person is the victim.
Gee, your job's hard because you're very reliant about those guys in the front line, aren't you?
They do a great job too.
Well, I reckon some would and some wouldn't. What about what we've just gone through? And it wasn't reported, the COVID, for 2 years. Was there a dramatic increase in what your...
Violence?
A lot of different things. Yeah. Because it was an unnatural situation having been locked down. Mentally it did with me, being literally locked down. It had an effect upon me. I would say in relationships it would have as well. And that wasn't really reported.
Yeah. Look, every other crime theme nosedived during COVID because So all other crime themes, you know, went downhill. Family violence kept going like a steam train. So it was
increased.
Yes,
the others
we've
went
had increases
down.
Every year, mind you, for the last in the last 20 years. We didn't have an increase in 2017, and we're not really sure why. And this year, I think we'll plateau. But if you go over the last 5 years, which includes the 2 years of COVID, yes, it increased. What we did during COVID was we did Operation Ribbon, and we actually asked our investigators at the family violence units and our frontline to be proactive and go out and check on high-risk AFMs and high-risk perps.
Oh, sorry, what were you talking? What do you mean?
AFM, affected family members. So we knew people who were subjected to family violence, and we proactively went out and engaged with them in a safe way. We had to sort of navigate that. But absolutely during COVID, family violence did not stop. And okay. And I think in some cases, if I look at the increases in elder abuse and adolescents committing family violence against their parents, yep. A lot of that was, I think, driven by the circumstances of being locked down with family. You don't necessarily want to spend your whole day.
So you're proactive rather than reactive.
We were. We were proactive. It was, I think it was one of the successful operations we ran.
So maybe the last question for me. So you're the Assistant Commissioner for Family Violence Command. Do you find that you're... do you have any... You've the subject of any threats or targets from people that that do you find any retribution that comes back to your department or you personally? And this is one of the things you've got to be wary of. Just thought that if I was just trying to put myself in your position, mm-hmm. if I was doing all this, you might have aggrieved people and say, oh, well, you've got to stop listening to her and all that. I don't know. Well, I'm just asking you, have you found any savagery towards you in any sort of form?
Well, I'm not on a lot of social media, but I am on LinkedIn. And whenever I post something around gendered harm and family violence, there's a couple of men out there who love to give it back to me big time. You know, they'll write, because I also talk about women's leadership and things like that. So I do get a lot of criticism. I tend to see the same names, you know, popping up on LinkedIn. So thank God I'm not on Facebook or anything else. And so there's that. But I'm used to it now. I'm like, bring it on, whatever. But I do have a man who writes to me from prison to the police centre, not to my personal address.
And he's there because
he murdered his wife, yes. Yep. And he... cuts things out of the paper if I'm in the newspaper. So, yeah, that's an unusual one. I think he's going to be in for a very long time, so I'm quite confident we're not going to run into each other.
Well, Don, are you done? Or Sue or Ivan? I know you because I've had the microphone here. I'm sorry about that. It's been a very appropriate discussion to have with Lauren Calloway because the new year starts and we start hopefully afresh. Things just push on, and it's a poignant reminder that this is going on, Don. And while I don't think we've been responsible for any of what is going on, I'd hate to think so, or people would know by now if we had been. There's plenty of things happening out there that are pretty antisocial, aren't there?
There are. And I think, you know, people want to feel safe. It's not just when you go down the street to go to a restaurant for dinner or you're on the road. I think, you know, that safety aspect. Imagine if you went home and that's the place where you are treated the worst. Can you imagine it?
Well, Lauren Calloway from the Assistant Commissioner for Family Violence, Command Police. Thank you very much for coming in and being part of this, Lauren. We really do appreciate it. And you are our first guest for 2023 on You Cannot Be Serious. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Worry because you ain't treating me right. Come back again. I'm just crazy about you.